Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, CEO and founder of Finstrat Management. With us today, we've got Shane Emmons. Shane is the founder and CEO of Swept. Shane, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's a joy.
Hey, glad you're here. Let's start with Swept. Tell us about the firm. What problem is it solving in the market?
Yeah, so Swept is trying to solve what we'd call the trust problem with AI, specifically for folks that are developing or buying AI agents and agentic software. Doesn't work like what everybody's used to from the last 30 years. It is sometimes consistent, sometimes wacky. And our job is to help you understand that and then to help plug the holes and get it as consistent as possible. And when it's not, to alert you to it.
Why can AI be wacky? What's at the root?
Everybody's going to throw around different fancy terms. They're going to talk about non-determinism or stochasticism or probability. And it really just comes down to AI is making an educated guess through all of its training of what it should do next. And it's not certain. There's also a little bit of randomness thrown in there to be creative. And that makes it sometimes what I would say is wacky, but you could also get to where it can be extremely harmful. I mean, we originally were started because we saw an AI agent perform some pretty bad harm to some teenagers that were trying to seek help. And that's where we were like, well, this is going to be a common pattern. So let's make sure it doesn't go that way. So yeah, I say wacky to tame down what is a pretty big risk in a lot of areas.
And is it structural around the technology? Is it a limitation on the data that LLMs are used to train on, or other? What's causing this to happen?
Yep. So it goes down to any system that you're building with. We'll use the word AI, whether it's generative AI or it's machine learning. It's an imperfect system thing. It's trying to detect patterns in all of this data. And if it was a perfect machine and got the patterns right every time, we'd have something called an algorithm. We just repeat it and we wouldn't need AI for that. AI is meant for predicting things where we don't have perfect knowledge. And so that's just a fundamental, you can see it as a limitation, but you also can see it as really, I think of it as a benefit of AI, because there are all kinds of algorithms that we couldn't have without having something that is predicting or probabilistic. It just wouldn't exist today.
So while we're on the subject, superintelligence, you know, there are a lot of stories of the money that Meta and OpenAI are spending to attract and retain data scientists. What is superintelligence? And I mean, I suspect I know what it is, but for benefit of our audience, let's start there.
Yeah, if we'll start first with general intelligence, because you have a growing chasm here. So general intelligence is AI systems that are as smart as any human. So they're able to perform any of our knowledge tasks. And it's a fuzzy definition because we're always moving the goalpost on what does it really mean to be as smart as any other human into what we do, because we're always finding new creative things. But super intelligence is the idea of an AI system or suite of systems that is not smarter than one human, but that smarter than every human combined. And so that's the goal that these labs are chasing, is this idea that they will create an artificial intelligence, an algorithm, a predictor that is better at predicting than all of us globally combined together.
And so when I think of prediction, is that a terminology that people who are steeped in AI use to just use outcomes in general, or is it supposed to be prediction? I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. You know, if I ask AI 1 + 1, I expect it'll consistently return 2. But if I ask AI, what's tomorrow's stock chart? or Apple stock price going to do, you may get a different answer because it's unknown. How should I think of those two different scenarios for purposes of generative and eventually super intelligence?
So in the cases with like 1 plus 1, I mean, not surprisingly, AI will get slightly more difficult problems wrong, because what it's actually doing on there is prediction. It is seeing the problem 1 plus 1 so many times that it doesn't know that it's 2, but it knows the most likely next answer is 2. If somewhere on the internet, somebody, there are definitely places where people say 1 plus 1 equals 3. The AI can occasionally pull those back and say 1 plus 1 is 3. We are getting better now with things that allow them to use tools. So, like humans, let's go use a calculator, because instead of predicting this, we can figure out the tool to use to do it. And so now, when you get to something like predicting the stock market or predicting how drugs will interact, that's where you're making educated, kind of science-based or finance-based guesses, where there is still some degree of either belief, or there's not a full information about the model. So again, it just is a model that it has of what this prediction is, and it makes it, but it usually, versus us, has far more inputs to consider. But in the end, it's still probabilistic. But even that 1 plus 1, that's probabilistic, unless somebody goes in there and tweaks the large language model to say 1 plus 1 is always 2. It has a slight chance that somebody on Reddit has said 1 plus 1 equals 3, and it will respond with that.
All right, so that's super helpful. I'm sure the audience benefits understanding that when we say prediction, it's the way the math works. Unless, to your point, that someone programs it to actually use a calculator,
Exactly.
where the answers are known. Okay, really helpful. Okay, so when I hear that, I hear inference. It's like, what's the intent of the person who's using the tool? And then there can be variability because you have to communicate, effectively communicate what you're looking for. But then there can still be issues on the underlying model. You use Reddit as an example, and so, the source of information that's being used to train the model then becomes crucial. Without revealing any IP, how does SWEP start to address these, I won't say shortcomings or limitations, but reality of
Yeah,
today's versions of AI?
exactly. It is the reality of these systems, and that's where we take the stance of understanding that that's their reality. So let's, when we're testing them and trying to figure out how they function, one of the first things we do is we don't go down to the model level, the ChatGPTs, the Claudes, the Geminis of the world, because they have, you can think of it as like infinite possibility. They can accept any input and have infinite types of output. So you can't really know, other than if you want to just specifically test some very small things, how well they're going to do at anything. So we go up one level and say, okay, we're going to work with an AI agent that maybe it's made to help quote for a manufacturer of, let me quote on these bids here. I'm going to quote them and send them out. And so now we know that this agent, this AI system is scoped to just do this one task. And now we've at least turned the realm of possibility from the entire scope of knowledge in the world to this thing, and can treat everything else as stuff that it shouldn't do. And from there, we then have proprietary IP of ways to essentially assess that don't try to do better than the AI system, but instead you can think of us more like we are a professor who already knows the answers, and we are going to go see how well do you get to those answers consistently, and test really your consistency on being able to go into things that we know you should be able to do, as well as, depending on the risk profile, maybe also checking things that we know you should not be able to do.
So almost like a traffic cop,
Yes.
not only knowing what the drivers are supposed to be doing, but redirecting them if they're not.
Exactly. Yep. So stepping in there with policy that says do not go on this, that's a big deal for things in the medical setting, where you may have, people use the word guardrails to talk about AI, where they're like, we're going to put guardrails so it doesn't do these things. Guardrails can still be smashed through by semis and, jumped by people. And so that's where we come in and actually put hardline policy that just because you told the agent you can't prescribe more than 100 milligrams of this drug doesn't mean it won't occasionally choose that for whatever reason. And so you want to have hardline policy in place that stops it.
So then, I'm sure, like myself, many of us have heard stories of how people continue to try to attempt to trick models into sharing information they're not supposed to. How do I make a nuclear bomb, for sake of example? And I hear stories of how they're still able successfully to get the models to share the information. How is it that what you guys are doing is different? Or is the tech is this ever evolving where you constantly have to start or continue to incorporate improvements in your own algorithms to, prevent people from doing or using models the way they're not supposed to?
Yeah, this is really a yes and one of really, we have to take lessons from the cybersecurity world from the last 30 years. And no matter how many trainings we've all sat through about not getting social engineering and don't respond to phishing emails, people still do it. I'm sure many of us have failed on the credit card scams that we just don't notice until we're too late. And AI has the same vulnerability. That doesn't mean that we don't stop. I usually bucket it as firefighting and fire prevention. You still need to put as much fire prevention. So you need to work to combat these with AI agents of don't do this, put these policies, put these guardrails in place. But also you have to go with the inevitability of when it happens, what are we going to do about it? And so that's where we take a different look of we're n trusting the companies themselves and other experts on working on the fire prevention. And we go the firefighting, the detection. Okay, when you detect enough signal that says it looks like somebody's trying to jailbreak us, do prompt leaks, do that, let's throw up alerts and block them versus trying to look at every single one and decide if it's good or bad. Let's just make judgments. And then you can think of it almost like a spam filter of your spam filter is making judgments. And most of the time, Gmail's spam filter is good. Sometimes stuff gets flagged in there that's not. Sometimes things get flagged through. Same idea needs to go through here so that eventually you're getting most of it taken care of. And you always need a plan for what's going to happen. It's a lot of this too goes down to understanding the risk and what is the risk if somebody does X, if they try to jailbreak your model and leak the prompt. Is that really that big of a deal? If it is, you need to find some other way to do this. Or if they can, a lot of agents now, the zeitgeist, everybody's talking about the tools that they can use, the tool calls. What can they do so they connect to the rest of the world? If somebody can ask the agent to make arbitrary tool calls, you really just need to make sure that those APIs and systems it's calling are properly secured versus trusting the AI is only going to make the right calls there. We should do the same thing again. I like to think of it, and we often talk about AI is just an eager intern. It really wants to please you. It wants to do everything. It doesn't think through. It has no experience or knowledge. It just wants to do the task, which is fine. But we should understand that and make sure that, we don't let interns come in and completely run our business on day one, probably ever. They takes years to get there. AI needs to be thought about the same way, especially right now. We may have, and I would think we'll have big breakthroughs over the coming years that really help curb some of this, but there's still going to be the black and white hat hackers who are going to try to prove that we can get around it, just like we have today, in our offices.
Man, I got a ton more questions, but that makes good sense. Hey, if we take a look back at your career, what did how did it what does it look like leading up to here, and how did you get your AI education?
Yeah, so my AI education started 25 years ago. University, got my undergrad and graduate degree in computer science with a focus in AI specifically. How do you handle these systems in production? Because they are unlike anything that we had been used to for the 60 plus years of doing computing at that point. Spent a decade data scientist in the insurance industry, cutting my teeth and learning these firsthand, watching us pay out $1 million extra 1 year to agents because they figured out the machine learning model had a flaw in it that they could make some more money if they just wrote policies a certain way, which lesson learned, didn't hurt the company. But we all learned big lessons there. Then moved into the startup world about 15 years ago or so, and was a CTO, helped build little models in place, but also big APIs and customers, and learned everything there is to know about, and not everything, I'd say, but a lot of what there is to know about human nature and the way things happen inside of technology, which is where it then just comes to collide. If I'm It's quite fascinating to watch how quick, how lazy people are. That's just our nature. And so we stop paying attention to the AI problems really quickly. And so how can we help that?
So, for those of us who are maybe not in a position to go back to school, but are still interested in becoming, have a stronger repertoire than someone who's an amateur, where do you think, where's, what do you suggest is a great starting point to go
I
to?
mean, For me, I think it's always starting with Claude, Gemini, or ChatGPT, and using it all the time. And all the time being, don't have it do simple things for you, like go rewrite this email or something, but start having it as a thought partner and asking it questions. Or what am I not thinking about? Of maybe you're doing a presentation, upload the presentation, start talking to it. Usually the next step is like start role playing and getting to understand how it can reflect to you different ideas than your own, which is usually one of the big unlocks people have, is it will take on different personas and therefore reflect things that you're not expecting. From there, it's usually to really start, and this is all to get a sense of how AI functions, and you're going to start seeing the cracks and flaws that come through. Which is great. That's what you're trying to train, is that muscle of understanding where the edges are of the system. Connect it to your various systems so that you can start asking it things like, tell me about my day tomorrow and everything I've talked to about these people before, and start building these ideas up. Again, it gets you some ideas of where the flaws are, and then take it further eventually into OpenAI just released, at least, I don't know if it's public versus private beta, but their agent builder, where you can connect tools and start understanding the idea of workflows. Because the big unlock that most people have yet to experience is going beyond chatting with an AI system to having it work for them. But most people I find have a really hard time of cresting the idea of having it do work for you without going through these baby steps of getting up to understand it. And then, I mean, fundamentally, you don't need to go learn data science. You don't need to know anything more than AI is literally reading pretty much at this point the entirety of the internet. And so if something's on the internet somewhere, it has a probability that it's going to reference that to your question you asked. And so thinking about that and how it may inform the ways that you're going to formulate the questions you ask or the prompts, or the way you're going to give it context, steer it towards what you might consider appropriate resources. And just imagine, the other thing I like to imagine is that inside of the LLM is a computer algorithm for like anything you ever want to do that's really close, but not quite right. And just know that you're trying to essentially seek that inside there by constantly tuning until you find it.
So, offshoot of that, large language models as well as small. In layman's terms, I understand it's just what's the data set that the model is trained on. What different implications are there for a user who's going to employ a large versus a small?
So the larger, the more knowledge it has. I would say the more likely it is to have your algorithm that we just called your answer inside of it, or at least something that's close to approximating it. And a lot of these models that you see that are open weight, I think the word they use is quantized, but they try to make them smaller and smaller to work faster. They are cutting portions of that knowledge base off that they don't think are necessary. Doesn't mean that can be good. But it could also mean that you've lost a part of your information, and maybe what could have been a 86% success rate for the task you were trying to do is going to be in the 70s. But there is cool new ways that people are doing this, of they're starting with the large language, the very large ones, the 600 plus, parameter, 600 billion plus parameters. And they're training, and they can use something like SWEPT, where you can sit there, not training, but evaluating the model and eventually finding where inside of that model most of your value is. Essentially, it can trace close to the brain. And then you can start cutting off the other places and making a small model that's for you. But today, if you're doing a small model that's just been shrunk, it's more like we're trying to make this answer more general purpose, things like creativity or X, Y, and Z, but it's never going to be as complex as those models that just are gigantic and have everything inside of them. So my suggestion usually to everybody is start with the biggest, and you can test the smaller ones to see if they keep up or keep well enough for what you're trying to do. But if it really matters, start with the biggest and then use a tool like SWEPT to cut it down to potentially an extremely small model that just does your niche.
And okay, so SWEPT assists maintain accuracy, but it sounds like the benefit here is that you also reduce your compute, so you save costs and perhaps amount of time that it takes to generate a response.
Yep, if yeah, it I'd say it definitely costs more to fine-tune a model to that small spot, because that's just a you're going to have to use lots of NVIDIA GPUs or somebody else's to do that retraining. But in the end, you end up with a much smaller, cheaper, faster model. And it just depends on your position and how much you're experimenting right now too. Maybe that's something you do a year or two after releasing when you really got it, or maybe it's critical today because you need to put it on a medical device.
Yeah, I was going to say use cases. Obviously, there's a lot of devices in the field. I presume you can run a small model locally.
Yeah, it's the iPhone is a great example of there are multiple, I think there's 20 plus small foundational models in the latest release of iOS that are running very specific tasks now, and they've been quantized to just do that one thing. Maybe it's language translation or mathematics on the Notes app. That's the kind of thing you want to do, but you can get it to, devices on the edge if you take the time to shrink them down.
Well, what do you see on the road ahead? What does the next year look like? The next 5 years, next 10 years?
Yeah, it's 5 and 10 years tough, but the next year, I think, is going to be a lot of us finally cresting the hill of getting past working with chatbots and maybe having to do a little bit of deep research, which is our first agentic flow, in truly taking over some workflows. We've seen that personally ourselves. We've started to automate a lot more through agents and thinking, and these early coding agents that a lot of people are using are really showing their promise on doing work outside of coding that can really move businesses. That's what I suspect over the next year is we've now got great tool calling, the ability to use things other than their own brain to think. They're able to use the outside world or outside software at least. That's the next year to potentially the next 2 years. There's just so many businesses, despite that MIT paper that said, AI is not bringing it back. If you go back now and look, they are starting to bring it at G2 just had a great publication about agents are actually starting to bring ROI, and that's where they're bringing ROI. It's not in copilots to ask information about your handbook. It's about agents actually doing work for your team. Then I think what really comes 5 years down the road, which this is everybody rightfully is probably a little bit uncomfortable because they can't see it, but it's when agents start doing this work that I would argue is kind of busy work, if an AI agent can do it at almost the same quality as a person can, it's probably not something that's we want to do at that point. And what's exciting for me and what I look for is like, what are the things we're going to do? I don't think that why we have SWEPT is I don't think we should become AI babysitters. Let's let software do that. But what can we do and open it up? I think about accountants who before Excel had giant pieces of paper and probably closed books for weeks, if not months. And now with Excel and QuickBooks and that, it's closer to button presses. Granted, we've added new complexity to eke out more information. So what new things will we discover for 5 years and 10 years just down the road? Who knows? I mean, if Meta And those have their ways. They'll hit super intelligence and we'll have a world like we won't, can't predict. I don't know if that will happen. I'd predict more of we're just going to see a technical revolution and a lot of us knowledge workers who were busy pushing bits and bytes around the world will have some brand new thing we're doing. I think it's going to be more exciting. I don't think we're going to be bummed about it, but it's going to take some pain to get through there and see what it's like.
It will be interesting to see how it plays out. And right now we're recording this late October 2025. It seems in the last week or two, I keep seeing references to slop in the headlines. Can you fill us in?
Oh yeah.
What's
AI
the
slop, it's the rightfully derogatory term of we're putting out a lot of content. AI is writing all kinds of marketing and blog posts, and it's making art that is at best we'll call it like corporate art. It doesn't have maybe emotion and movement. And so we're calling it slop, and it's a natural reaction to we don't it's we used to talk about it in CGI as the uncanny valley. It's something that feels really close to human, but there's something wrong with it. People rightfully pick on AI loves using those M dashes, those elongated dashes and everything instead of parentheses for whatever reason. I think it's because it's shown in scientific papers all the time because they know how to use it, and we don't use it in general work. But for whatever reason, that shows us of it's in this uncanny valley of that blog post wasn't written by a person, that was an AI, and we're rejecting it immediately. And when you read a lot of this, it is slop, it's repetitive. You'll watch people, post 500,000 articles all of a sudden on their website to try to garner traffic. But we did that in the early days of SEO and Google too, where we were trying to game the system. And I think that we're going to go back from it. And the AI slop is eventually going to calm down and either become quality content or just turn off because it's going to stop influencing us. We're all trying to figure out how to essentially, get more recognition so that we get money and grow our businesses. This is a brute force way. And everybody, Google's going to change their algorithms. OpenAI, Perplexity will change their algorithms. And slop will die off. People still find it funny, but that's why we have memes. I think it will get back closer to the, ridiculous memes, and those don't flood the internet the way they did in the early days when everybody did them.
Got it. Okay, very helpful. So then coming back to agents, to me it seems like the value of an agent really is dependent on what the underlying use case is. The more simple the tasks, the higher probability it gets it right. And on the flip then, the more complicated, more error prone. But can you comment on, like, if you look at a spectrum of complexity, how often are agents getting the simple tasks right? How far off are we from, and how dependent on the complexity of the task are we to getting it correct?
I would say there's been a leap in the last 6 months around the complexity of the task. We had up until about 6 months ago consistently needed to use AI where one prompt or one turn of the crank could produce the result. But we've been able to build agentics now that are quite more reliable. Well, they'll make sub agents of, okay, there's this big task. Now we have a planner that's going to go and plan the project or the task out. Here's all the things we need to do. And I'm not going to do it myself. I'm going to farm it out to other agents who are specialized in that piece. So we're just over the last 6 months. That's why there's been exploding of coding agents that have worked really well, is they've learned this and now we're starting to see it apply elsewhere. And so had you asked me 6 months ago and we hadn't had these breakthroughs, I'd say yes, simpler tasks are easier because they can one-shot it. A few examples, it makes sense, the agent can do it. Now agents are able to plan in each of those smaller tasks once it break down, have good enough examples that they do, it goes back to the small task, really good at it, and then they combine together. So now it's just a question of how well do you know your processes so that you can judge the breakdown of those tasks first? Because if you can judge them really well and it's not like, oh, well, I feel this, If you can true the companies who are winning are the ones who have excellent understanding of their internal operations of how these things work, and they can go, well, we do this, and it's not quite an assembly line. There's still creativity and maybe the results or the judgments that are made, but they understand the workflow. As soon as you understand the workflow now, it becomes much better. You can reap amazing rewards, and then it just becomes the balance of how much does this cost from a compute and energy standpoint versus the human that was doing it before. And then for swept, we also come in and say, how much does the oversight cost you? Because if a human's now tasked with reviewing everything, we find a lot of times, say you're doing a claims adjustment or underwriting an insurance place capacity, you would have where you're not making the value back because the person that's checking it could have quoted that policy faster or could have decided on that claim adjustment faster by themselves than having to check the AI. However, if you're able to figure out how to do the checking, which is where Swept excels, and remove the person so all they have to do is be alerted to outliers, that's where you can suddenly start making the economic rewards of these systems and redirect your workforce to something else that actually makes the value there.
So, I like your eager intern analogy. And one of the things that what I heard was a manager reference. Is there a concept of rewarding behavior for
I
agents?
mean, agents are rewarded, and the way we do rewarding today is through, sometimes I think it's unfortunate, but the way the big models are is they are rewarded through reinforcement learning with human feedback. So the reason we have this chat interface is they have a whole suite of people and tests that teach the agent how we want to interact with it and have that. We've seen it before where they get way too overeager in terms of like, yes, you're smart, you're so great. And trying to tone, that's where I wish we would tone it down and consider alternatives versus the other problem I see is the constant reward mechanism of keep the conversation going, of it always asks you a follow-up, which is not great for workflows. I want my workflow to stop, not to continuously work. So that's where you have to do it. But there are all AI, when it boils down to it, is that reward mechanism of did it get the correct answer? It gets a reward. Did it get the wrong answer? Usually it just doesn't get a reward. Sometimes you would do a minus. And that's all that training actually is. These big, giant data centers are all about, I know the answers. When it gets it right, I'm going to give it a reward. When it gets it wrong, it's not. And we're just going to keep running calculations until it gets more rewards than not. And there's all kinds of AI studies around that, or in different disciplines that are extremely interesting. You can teach AI how to walk with nothing but rewards about standing up and stuff like that. But there's all kinds of very interesting things. And then when you're working with your own system, fine-tuning is a reward-based system. Hey, these were the good answers. Let's reward you with these. Remember them for the future so that you act more like that.
Wealth of information. I love it, Shane. Thank you. Before we wrap up, as you reflect back, you had a chance to do anything different at any point. What's on the list?
I definitely am a pretty much zero regrets. Everything teaches you something. If I re reflect back in Swept in particular, we started out bootstrapping and then we got it in our minds that we're a startup. We need to go raise venture capital. And I think we spent 3 to 4 months too focused on trying to raise venture capital and not enough focus on building good fundamentals in the business. Once we recognized that and went back and built good fundamentals in the business, we had investors pull us in and get excited about us and that. That's probably the biggest one that I regret, and I constantly reflect with my co-founder Amy now, is when we're doing things now, are we doing things to try to get investors for a seed round? Are we doing good things that are making this business fundamentally good and that they're going to be excited? And I'd say it's a near constant battle to remind ourselves that because you get excited and you kind of shift your perspective. But that's the one thing I would go back and do a little bit differently. Otherwise, I feel like, all the scars are just memories and ways to learn.
I love that, and I agree. We're here because of everything that's happened leading up to it. Love to give you an opportunity to give a shout out to anyone in your life, personally, professionally, who's had a material impact.
Yeah, I'd say professionally, one of my biggest impacts, I'm gonna cheat and say two. One is the CEO of the Team Snap that really gave me my break into startups, Dave DuPont. And he taught me a lot, whether it was intentional or unintentional, about taking bets on people and really investing in them. So I joined as the second engineer and was CTO not too long after and helped turn that company from a few thousand users to 26 million. And that's because of a belief in, that he had in me of being able to grow that company for somebody who had never managed a person to, I think we had 80 engineers underneath me at one point. And then I've had an executive coach for nearly a decade, Keith Marin, and he's really pushed me consistently to think about how I want to run the business, not how the world tells you or you think the world tells you to run a business, and how to run it yourself and build it yourself. And doing that at Swept is so rewarding of like, okay, I do have a vision. Let's do it. Let's stop aligning to somebody else's belief of how this is done.
Fantastic. I love it. Well, shout out to Dave and Keith. Anything I haven't asked that you wanna share with the audience, or other?
I'm not really. I'd say if you're in, I'd say deploy more AI, and if it's a risk, talk to us and we can really help de-risk it.
Great. Shane, if there are any members of our audience who want to get a hold of you, learn more about Swept, how can they find you?
You can go to our website, swept.ai, send me an email note, shane@swept.ai, or if you want to send it to everybody here, hello@swept.ai, and we'll all get it and respond to you.
Awesome. Shane, really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Right on.
Awesome. And again, Shane Emmons, founder, CEO, Swept AI. Again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, CEO, founder of FinStrat Management. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Innovators Investors Podcast. Take care. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com/podcast-guest. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag innovators and investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.